Second Lady Karen Pence visits Jacksonville as both the president and the first lady test positive for coronavirus. A string of shootings and gun violence across the city this week. And new revelations about the ways Florida Power & Light tried to purchase JEA. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, all of the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. You'll want to join this one. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, how the show must go on at one local theater company, even in this pandemic. We'll tell you about their creative solution. But first, it's Friday. Here to discuss a wild week in the news, we welcome Nate Monroe of the Florida Times Union. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Ann Schindler of First Coast News is with us. Hi, Ann. Oh, we'll connect Ann in just a moment. Google Hangouts can be a little tricky at times. Mike Mendenhall of the Jax Daily Record. Hi, Mike. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And freelance journalist Shelton Hull.
Good morning.
So good to have you all on the show. Lots to talk about this week. And give us a call, everyone, as we talk about the week that was in the news. The number to join our Friday roundtable, 549-2937. But first this hour, the latest on the COVID crisis by the numbers. 14,444 people around the state have died of COVID-19. 127 new deaths were added to the official statewide total yesterday. There are 709,144 people who have tested positive for coronavirus, with 2,628 new cases yesterday. And of course, the most famous Florida resident on earth is now one of those people. As we've heard this morning, both the President of the United States and the First Lady have tested positive for coronavirus. They will quarantine in the White House for the next 2 weeks. This is terrible news. We wish both the President and the First Lady and his aide Hope Hicks, who is also positive, a full recovery. This is a terrible and frightening disease, and you just wouldn't wish it on anyone. Now, as we continue to talk about this, we need to note that the president was just here in Jacksonville for a big outdoor rally at Cecil Airport. There was some criticism of this event because most of the attendees were not wearing masks or socially distanced. The president has also had to cancel a visit to Sanford, Florida, set for today, since he is positive for the virus. Meanwhile, we have learned that Vice President Mike Pence and his wife Karen Pence have tested negative for the virus. And we bring this up because Mrs. Pence was in Jacksonville Wednesday, where she visited several spots, including the local veteran charity Canines for Warriors. She stopped by NAS Jacks and also the Social Grounds coffee shop in Springfield. Now, as we talk about this monumental news, we want your calls. It's 549-2937. Join us. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open too. Nate Monroe, let's begin with you. The whole world is digesting this news right now that the president and the first lady have coronavirus. And there are a couple of Jacksonville connections to this. As I mentioned, the president was just here for a big rally at Cecil Airport, and Mrs. Pence, the second lady, who is negative for the virus, thankfully, was also here just the other day. And so as we talk about this news and how it will affect the final weeks of the presidential campaign, what are your initial thoughts?
Well, I'm still mid-digestion here. So, I mean, honestly, part of my reaction is a level of anger that this is happening. I mean, this president has downplayed this virus. He has expressed scorn and mockery of people who wear masks. It's well reported that his aides don't wear masks around him because of his distaste for them. And it's troubling because this White House has lies with such a consistent pattern that, I mean, I'm curious to know if aspects of this timeline and some of the underlying facts prove to be true in the end. And
we don't know that.
But that's what happens when public officials deliberately don't tell the truth.
Ann Schindler, Ann Schindler, are you back with us?
Yeah, can you hear me all right, Melissa?
I sure can. Nate commented on the fact that the president and his administration have been heavily criticized for some time now for not taking this virus seriously and not following the advice of public health experts and doctors who have pleaded with the public to wear masks and to socially distance. And, you know, as we talk about all of this, we are back to a phase three reopening of the state. Governor DeSantis has essentially said, let's get back to normal. Although not all businesses are following that protocol, some are still observing some restrictions in our area. But, you know, the fact that we now have the leader of the country and his wife sick with this virus is a reminder that this virus is still very much with us and we do need to continue to be careful.
That's right. And I think, you know, to Nate's point, I mean, people are able to make their own choices. And I think that that's still true. But I think the concern is when someone in a position of power is using leverage to either, you know, encourage people or even bully people not to do something that's safe for them and their families. And, you know, the lack of choice that's been given, for instance, local school districts, when it comes to coming up with a plan that allows students and teachers to safely return, you know, not having that autonomy or the ability to make those decisions on a local level based on the needs and the desires and the health concerns in your specific area or even in your home is, you know, problematic for a lot of people. And it is contributing, I think, to a sense of, you know, well, it's contributing, I think, to obviously the continuation of this virus. I mean, we're seeing this week all of these football teams having to cancel games, both high school teams and professional teams, and the full weight of where this virus is going for the remainder of the year is still really in the balance.
That's right. If you're tuning in just now, it's our Friday roundtable. Let us know your thoughts to the huge news that the president and the first lady have tested positive for coronavirus. We're talking about that and other news of the week at 549-2937. Shelton Hull, getting back to the visit from the first lady, Karen Pence did stop by several places in town this week, including NAS Jax, Canines for Warriors. That is the veterans charity run by Jacksonville City Councilman Rory Diamond. And she visited a coffee shop in Springfield. Councilman Diamond just tweeted a minute ago, appreciate all of the thoughtful concern this morning. The second lady tested negative for COVID and we followed all social distancing protocols during her visit, he says. Your thoughts?
Well, first of all, Canines for Warriors is a great organization. It was nice that she was out there trying to help people that are helping the veterans. Now, the situation with the president just goes to show how universal this disease is. And it's kind of paradoxical, though, because on the one hand, he has all the resources in the world and access to the finest medical care, but he's a good example of how many of us in our regular lives are not able to effectively socially distance. We have to be around people. We have to be out there in the community. And with these, the situation with the rally in Jacksonville, I remember people were saying during the run-up to maybe having the convention here, one of the big concerns was always the possibility of a super spreader event. People were making little jokes and whatnot to that effect when he was in town last week. I'm surprised that just for the campaign's sake, that they're not being more aggressive about doing contact tracing of the people there at the rally. I would say, of course, they take temperatures and stuff, but I would say anyone who goes to one of these events should probably be required to be tested, say, 5-7 days afterwards. And it's unfortunate. We don't want this to happen to anybody. It's been very universal. Everyone I know has either been directly affected or had a loved one directly affected by this. And, hopefully things pick up, but there's no way of knowing at this point.
Yeah. I mean, we just can't stress this enough. This disease is no joke, people. It is serious. And Mike Mendenhall, as Shelton Hull pointed out, of course, we did almost host the Republican National Convention here in Jacksonville. It didn't happen because of mounting concerns about coronavirus, and also because a number of local business owners in the downtown area sued arguing that it would be a threat to public safety and health. The rally at Cecil Airport was outdoors, and so we heard from the mayor that because folks were outdoors, they didn't have to mask up. The Duval County mask mandate applies to indoor gatherings. You are at less risk of contracting coronavirus if you're outside. That's why we're seeing a lot of people going to restaurants and trying to sit outside rather than inside right now. That said, a lot of people packed into a space, even an outdoor space that aren't masked, does still pose a risk. And we did see that at the Cecil Airport rally the other day.
Yeah. And if you look at the photographs from the event, I mean, it really did kind of in a way look like a rock concert for floor seating. You know, you had a lot of people that were like standing shoulder to shoulder at this event. And so, I mean, there is that risk. And it, you know, and just the fact that, you know, President Trump contracting coronavirus, and it was the same week that Mayor Curry actually extended Duval County's mask mandate. And like you said, although it's indoors, you know, you have a local Republican official who is still stressing face masks while the president of the United States, while he's here at an event, you know, shortly before he contracts coronavirus. So, I mean, the optics and the imagery of that, you know, it's hard to escape.
Lots of calls. It's our Friday roundtable. Let us know your thoughts about the local connections we are going over to the global news that the President of the United States and the First Lady have tested positive for coronavirus. It's 549-2937. Mary is in San Marco. Go ahead, Mary. You're on the air.
Yes. Yes. My first thought was about their son. How's he doing? And if he goes to school, if those children have been exposed.
Yeah. Thanks for that, Mary. Yeah. Certainly the president's son is in close quarters with his parents, as you would expect. And we just don't know whether he's been affected. But, you know, Nate, that just brings up a related point. We've all sent our kids back, all of us with children, most of us have sent our kids back to school in this area. The majority of parents in our area with school-aged children have sent their children back to class, and they have to deal with the stress of positive cases in the Duval, St. John's, Nassau County school systems. This is just something anyone with children is worried about, and if a parent contracts COVID, for example, the family in Atlantic Beach, a father contracted COVID and he had a mild case, but his 12-year-old daughter got the virus from him and died last week. And so we had the youngest reported death in our area from COVID. And it was because she got it not from school, but from her own father. We just can't stress enough how contagious this virus is what I'm getting at.
Sure. A former colleague of mine who now covers the coronavirus for the Miami Herald noted this morning, and I think this is a good point, that, you know, the Florida strategy and the strategy in a lot of other states has essentially been that, oh, well, for most young people, the coronavirus is not a problem, and it's really just old people we need to worry about. But people don't live in silos. That's just a fact of everyday life. And now that reality has pierced the White House.
Jeff at the beaches. Go ahead, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, my comment is, you know, I'm wondering whether or not it's real news. I mean, it's brilliant strategy. He doesn't have to debate. He gets out of having to debate. And he's gaining sympathy with his supporters. So, you know, God forbid it isn't fake news, but I mean, I question it.
Jeff, thanks for that. Ann Schindler, certainly there's been some chatter on social media echoing Jeff's comments, but you know, at this point, I think we have to proceed under the knowledge that this is real because a number of world leaders we need to point out, including Boris Johnson in Britain, prime ministers in South America, have also contracted this disease. The president is not the first world leader to get this disease.
Yeah, I think that the caller's point is just an example of how far we've gone in terms of people you know, destabilizing this country in terms of what is true and what is not, you know, what we can rely on from this president and what is still very much in question, you know, and a big part of that is because he contradicts pretty much every person of authority he's, you know, he's appointed, whether it's in the health community or in the military community. You know, at some point he basically accuses them of lying or misleading people. And so when he does that, I think it just, you know, fans the flames of uncertainty.
The New York Times is apparently reporting just now that the president is complaining of minor symptoms of COVID-19. 549-2937. Lisa in Riverside. Go ahead, Lisa.
I just wanted to point out, I'm not sad at all for the president. In fact, right now I'm two things. I'm angry and I'm scared. And the reason I'm angry and scared is because the president of the United States now, who's sloughed off this whole virus, has now tested positive, and he has access to the best health care in the whole entire world, while the Supreme Court nominee who he has chosen has been very verbal about wanting to end Obama / the Affordable Care Act. And so thousands of people like myself are all at risk of losing our health care during a time of a pandemic.
Lisa, thanks for your call. Shelton Hall, healthcare, I think, is probably the most important issue that will be driving people's votes this election. We're going to have an election in 1 month, and this latest news has just shown the intensity of people's feelings on both sides about how we get healthcare coverage, how we handle that in this country. The pandemic has brought that home to millions of Americans.
Absolutely. And another thing we've seen through this pandemic, which reflects the healthcare situation, is this trend of putting aside the best advice of doctors and scientists in order to make it all a political thing. If you look back to the late 60s and early 70s, the first big pushes for universal healthcare were kind of done by Richard Nixon in conjunction with Ted Kennedy. Going back to the days of Medicare and Medicaid, a lot of those initiatives occurred on a bipartisan basis. But what we've seen since, I don't know, the 93, 94, when Hillary Clinton started with her healthcare reform plans, is that the actual needs of the American people have been put on the back burner in favor of just this partisan bickering between health insurance companies, drug companies, and the various politicians who work on their behalf. For the president, he is very lucky to be in the position he is with the access to the best health care in the world. But, you know, one thing he does have to worry about is that he is president. And so, like everyone else facing this disease, having Trump as president will create issues for him. The level of stress that he has to be under is incredible. And it's only going to get worse as we get closer to this election. The lady who said earlier that she thought maybe this was a gimmick, maybe something made up, you know, in order to gain sympathy for the president. We are in such cynical times now that, you know, we can consider the idea of shenanigans like that. But I would say that with this particular president, he would make no concessions as far as his physical health unless it was true. If anything, I would say if he's even suggesting that he's complaining of symptoms, I would guess that the symptoms might even be worse than that, because he would not sell it otherwise. He doesn't sell colds. He doesn't sell the flu. He was continuing to put himself at risk during this whole pandemic, continuing to shake hands, continuing to be out around people without masks. And, you know, we wish the best for him, but who knows?
We are being asked by multiple listeners to point out that at the September 24th rally at Cecil, where about 15,000 supporters of President Trump did turn out, everybody who attended that rally had to sign a waiver releasing any liability for contracting COVID-19 from the Trump campaign. That was a condition of your ticket. And so we're going to continue and take your calls on this big news, but we also need to talk about some other news of the week here on our Friday roundtable. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about the biggest stories of the week with Shelton Hall, Nate Monroe, Ann Schindler, Mike Mendenhall, four local journalists, and yours truly. It's 549-2937. Now, we will keep taking your calls about this bombshell regarding the president's COVID diagnosis, but some other news and notes now, too. There was a rash of gun violence this week across the city. Wednesday night, four people were shot at the Valeris apartment complex at Beach and Kernan Boulevards. There was a shooting at the Amazon warehouse on the north side as well. And the homicide tracker for Jacksonville stands at 113 for the year so far. I believe that is still the correct tally. The community group, the Northside Coalition, is pleading for a new approach to bringing down gun violence and homicide rates in this city. The city of Jacksonville has begun a new program called Cure Violence, which has had some success in a number of other cities around the country. And so let us know your thoughts about this, because we do remain the murder capital of Florida. It's 549-2937. Mike Mendenhall, this has been a bloody week across this city, multiple shooting incidents. And, you know, it's just this constant drumbeat of violence in this town that we talk about it again and again and again on this program. It just is a fact of life here, which is absolutely devastating for the public health and well-being of this city.
Yeah, and, you know, the strategy, you know, coming out of City Hall, I mean, is, you know, there've been multiple attempts over the years in Jacksonville to try to stem violence. You know, we just had a debate on funding for the police department, for the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office, and they have a, you know, a $483 million budget. You know, so I mean, the answer, it is not just money. I mean, there has to be a coherent strategy, but there are also a lot of ancillary, you know, issues that need to be addressed that are, you know, that cause the continual movement of violence from generation to generation. And you have social economic issues that need to be addressed, disparities that are left over from consolidation and even before, as well as, you know, education. And so it's not just going to be, it's not just going to be a law enforcement solution. There have to be solutions coming out of all aspects of society.
That's right. Nate Monroe, you've written quite a bit about the Cure Violence Initiative and, you know, how much has been allocated in the city budget to it. 131 homicides for the year so far, the worst ever since the TU started tracking that data, correct?
We're actually at 138 now.
Okay.
In perspective, we were at 119 at this point last year. So that is a significant escalation year over year. Homicides don't track, breaking them up over years is to some degree a bit of an artificial dividing line, but it's the best way we have to measure them. And it's clearly a trend that has just only gotten worse. What the city is doing, be it Cure Violence or the Kids Hope Alliance initiatives, all of the what are called intervention side programs, they are either not working or they are not ambitious enough in scope. Nothing is going to change until the city just candidly gets as serious about addressing this as it does enriching developers who want to build in downtown. I mean, it has to be a top priority, and it's not.
Ann Schindler, $484 million in the new city budget will go to the JSO next year. So we do spend a lot on law enforcement. There is no political will in Jacksonville to reallocate some of those dollars to crime prevention and intervention programs that some community activists say might do a better job at bringing down these numbers over time. That said, the city is spending some money on Cure Violence. You've been covering this as well. How do you see the Cure Violence program dealing with this issue?
Well, you know, that's one strategy. I mean, I think what you have to look at in terms of this week's insane violence is that, you know, like the shooting at the Amazon and the four people shot, those were both outside of the Cure Violence footprint. which is, you know, concentrated in neighborhoods that have had a particular kind of, you know, gang violence problem, and the, you know, the cure violence is supposed to interrupt retaliatory violence. So it's just one thread. You know, the Amazon thing was domestic violence, you know, which is a whole different kind of issue, perhaps. But I think the one unifying factor is not just the homicide rate, but the total shootings in this city, according to our tally, is 358 so far this year, which, you know, that's a problem of gun violence that we're not addressing at all. I mean, we talk about, you know, certain kinds of crime and sort of attack certain kinds of crime, but just the sheer number of weapons that are out there for when people get pissed off, you know, or get in an argument with their neighbors or their wife or whatever. It's just kind of this very accessible, deadly, you know, form of retaliation. And so that, I think, is also a part of the problem. And we're not even having that discussion in this city.
Yeah. Thank you for that, Anne, as well. Shelton Hull, Anne's right. The shooting incidents that we are talking about from this week come from spots all across Duval County, not in the old city center.
Mm-hmm. Anne is always right. And when it comes to this sort of thing, you know, people say that you can throw money at the problem and fix it. But if money were a solution, there would be no problem, because if all these different gangs and factions could put their differences aside, stop putting bodies in the street and focus on business, everyone's cash flow could easily be flipped over by a factor of 5 or 10. A lot of these situations come from domestic violence. Some are more random in nature, but it's an overall thing going on in the country. When the lockdown first happened, violent crime actually went down in a lot of major cities in America. Jacksonville was one of the few where the violence actually increased. And now that we've begun the reopening process, we're seeing in places like New York and Chicago, D.C., Atlanta, violent crime is spiking rapidly. People are settling scores. A lot of people are angry. There's a lot of tension. And Jacksonville is continuing along that way. We can break the crime down into different categories: domestic violence, gang violence, road rage, and whatnot. But there are no easy solutions. And, you know, as much as Jacksonville has really failed over the last 15 years to get any kind of a handle on this situation, in their defense, it should be said that no one in America has been successful in getting a handle on this yet.
A listener says, please point out that a JSO detective was also shot this week. Thanks for that. Lots of calls on this. CJ in Mandarin. Go ahead, CJ.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. This is really a society-wide failure. I mean, it's really on all of us. You know, the city of Jacksonville has ignored a lot of areas with high concentration of African Americans, and you're seeing a result of that. Also, you're seeing a result of the ravages of the war on drugs, because it really people lost, especially in communities of color, have lost the respect and lost the trust in police. And so now you see a more vigilante justice, an eye for an eye, people not cooperating with the police, so you're not seeing arrests being made. And then you see, I guess, street justice. And a lot of it has to do with economic depression in a lot of those areas. And we need to be able to, you know, try to get funds into people's pockets, but also we need to give the right attention, you know, try to get guns off the streets, you know, offer gun buybacks. But we really need to really take ownership of this, because it is going to take a village. It's not just black on black crime. I mean, that's such a terrible.
No, not at all. I appreciate your thoughts, CJ. It certainly is not. This is a countywide problem, and it is affecting all socioeconomic backgrounds, all neighborhoods. A listener points out, please remind everyone, the fatal shooting at Amazon was domestic related. Domestic Violence Awareness Month kicked off yesterday. That gets back to Anne's point. Jillian in Arlington. Go ahead, Jillian.
Morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Okay, briefly, I was in the urban core Wednesday night
little outdoor birthday party with 50 and older, very peaceful. Gave someone a lift home. Almost every street there was police presence, lights going. And it just made me think, I live in Arlington. It's not so bad where I live. I know where the police are up by the expressway. But can you imagine living in a neighborhood every night, every street, you can't even go to the store because they're going to pull you over? I was crossing US-1 and the police flashed the little light that's outside. I don't know if they're looking in the cars you crossing, but I have my seatbelt on, my license is straight. But it's predatory. And so I heard the person I was dropping off tell another man, it's not the same. I stay away from these young guys. And they're black men because the younger kids are in trouble and they don't have a regard for life for various reasons. And so even these older black men are like, I just stay away from them because basically they don't care. And then they did say that a police officer got shot. He said a young guy and a girl. And so because of that, what, the police come and retaliate even more and they put even more presence and they try to drop the hammer down. And the guy said, you know, I have my license and stuff, but they told me when I got stopped, they're not looking for that. They're looking for guns. They're looking for drugs. That's illegal search and seizure. So it's a lot going on, and JSO has the wrong idea. These kids can't even get a job at McDonald's because I was a teacher and a social worker. I taught remedial kids that supposedly couldn't read. They take away the PE and make them go to double math. They already depressed. They already don't feel like anything. At 16, they can drop out, and so they do. They get a little bit of weed. They sell drugs. They just automatically gonna get a felony before they like 18 or 19. They can't vote, and they can't get a job. So what they going to do for the rest of their life? It's not fair. So we need, like, felonies need to be very hard to get. They need to really work with these young kids. They need to try to give them a way to make money because that is why it's going on.
Yeah. Jillian, thank you. Jillian, thanks so much, because what you just described is the school to prison pipeline, which is driving a lot of this, not all of it, but some of the violence in this city. And Nate, there are an enormous number of people in this town working at different nonprofits, in city government, in the private sector, trying to get at this problem. Our prosecutor, Melissa Nelson, has made some changes to try to get at this problem. And so this is a big part of what so many cities, not just Jacksonville, as Shelton said, are dealing with. This is a big piece of criminal justice reform that we have not yet dealt with adequately.
Sure. And while it is, I think, important and fair to note that a lot of larger cities do grapple with some of these problems, it is also true that Jacksonville has bucked the recent trend in a lot of cities. The trend has been decreasing violent crime. Jacksonville's in the past several years has been going up, especially homicides. And it's important to ask ourselves why that is. You know, the answers are enormously complicated.
They are complicated. And we're running short on time, and I hate to cut you off, but I want to get to one other really big story from the week. Florida Power and Light's high-powered team of Jacksonville lobbyists met in the summer of last year, the TU reports, to brainstorm which charities the utility might give to that are close to the hearts of Jacksonville City Council members. All this happened as FP&L was working on what turned out to be a failed bid to purchase JEA. Specifically, they were looking to donate to nonprofits led by Rory Diamond, who we talked about a few minutes ago, the CEO of Canines for Warriors, and Jacoby Pittman, the CEO of the Clara White Mission. I want to get everyone's reaction to this who's on our panel, but I want to begin with you, Nate, since you and your colleagues at the Times Union broke this story.
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, the documents that we got and that went to the city council committee, I mean, they give you a pretty rare behind the scenes look at how Florida Power and Light, which is one of the, I mean, its parent company NextEra is one of the biggest companies in the world. And Florida Power and Light is one of the most powerful political forces in the state. And you get to see how they win support in a community. And they do it through money. You know, Florida Power and Light tells us that this is innocent, that they've been supporting charities in Jacksonville and across the state just before the JEA sale, and they'll continue to do it. But there are government watchdogs that have accused FP&L and other utilities of having a lot more cynical motives for this charitable giving. And, you know, really just as an attempt to kind of buy their way into favorable policy decisions.
Mike Mendenhall, your thoughts.
You know, this news also comes as the city council's investigation was extended for another 3 months. The special counsel that was hired to guide the city council through the investigation is trying to get contracts from a political consultant, Tim Baker, who worked for FPL in the lead up to JEA's invitation to negotiate. He's also linked to Mayor Curry. And so, you know, the coming interviews in this investigation of the city council are starting to kind of pivot toward the mayor's office, that possible involvement. This just underscores how, you know, Florida Power and Light was trying to position itself to get into close contact with people who, you know, with the decision makers.
Yeah, it did. We did get a peek behind the curtain into how they lobbied to win the day here in Jacksonville. Ann Schindler, as Mike points out, there is still a city council committee looking into this. But the big dog in this is the federal grand jury investigation into the failed effort to sell JEA to a private utility. Of course, they operate under a cloak of secrecy. We don't know yet how that will play out, whether anyone will be indicted. But that is still the big question the people following this process closely are asking.
Yeah, that's true. And it's a process into which I have zero insight. But, you know, kind of to the question of this charitable giving, you know, it's, I think Nate has pointed it out before, but when you have a lack of dedicated funds or resources to various, you know, types of needs in the community, it creates a dependence on philanthropic giving, which then creates this pipeline to influence. You know, you've got every city council member sort of has their charity of choice. Pretty much everybody in the city has their charity of choice. And it's because there is no dedicated funding to a lot of the city's more specific needs.
Yeah. I mean, Shelton Hull, most of the folks on the Jacksonville City Council have ties to this nonprofit or that nonprofit, and some of them are CEOs of nonprofits. And so this was illuminating to learn how FP&L worked the politicians in this city.
Yeah. The point Ann just made about how nonprofits and the private sector and our political class intersect is essential. And you can see that everywhere, but especially here locally with a lot of the situations that have happened in recent years, going back to, say, Kareem Brown, for example. As far as the FPL and JEA thing goes, I think it's a really great example of what quality local investigative reporting can do. You know, Nate may or may not agree, but my opinion has always been that if it weren't for the work that Nate and his colleagues were doing on this subject over at the Times Union, the sale would already have been done. This would have been done and we'd have never heard about any of this. People like Zahn and these people on the board, they would all still be in the positions that they're in. There'd be no grand jury investigation or investigation of any kind. And I think that when you, as these stories come out, the sort of brazen way in which people have attempted to peddle influence and curry favor, so to speak, with people, it happened so brazenly because no one expected pushback. This is not a time when the political class expects a lot of pushback from the media, because the media has been kind of on the ropes. Their backs have been against the wall. But cornered animals fight, and we have seen that very well in a, you know, the Times Union has probably saved this city billions of dollars in what would have otherwise been a terrible sale.
I think most folks would agree with that, Shelton. And here is a tweet from a listener. Please point out that Florida Power and Light needs new revenue. And he links to a story in the Miami Herald that Florida Power and Light was eyeing JEA ratepayer money to fix their leaking Turkey Point nuclear plant. There is a federal special inspection at Turkey Point after three unplanned shutdowns. Florida Power and Light is a utility giant, as you point out, Nate, but it has problems. And that's one of them. And certainly the attempt to acquire JEA, if it had been successful, could have brought a lot of new revenue to Florida Power and Light.
For sure. First, I do want to thank Shelton for those kind words, and I just feel obligated to note that there were other very important actors, like the city council's auditor and the ethics officer and some city council members who played very important roles in where we are today. JEA would have been a really important addition to NextEra's balance sheet, not only for cash flow purposes, but also because, I mean, look, NextEra has investments in a lot of things beyond utilities. The reason that NextEra likes to purchase them is because they are they're called regulated industries, and they are considered extremely stable investments. And investors like those because that gives the company stability. That really cuts against the whole death spiral narrative that we were sold in the past year by former JEA management. And so I've always found that to be kind of an amusing irony about, you know, why there were so many companies interested in paying a tremendous amount for JEA.
Yeah. Now, go ahead. Did somebody want to jump in? Okay. Before we wrap things up, Mike Mendenhall, let's touch on a positive note from the week. We saw new renderings for the planned park in downtown Jacksonville called Lift Every Voice and Sing Park. Of course, Jacksonville's own native son, James Weldon Johnson, penned what is now known as the Black National Anthem, Lift Every Voice and Sing, and it is going to be played at every NFL game this season. So that was kind of cool to see those plans move forward.
It really was, and I mean, the details of that park, you have a poet's walk, there's going to be a stage for live music. It's really going to pay homage to an area of Jacksonville with, you know, that has been almost leveled in recent decades, and hopefully it will bring some of that Black history and that cultural element that really Jacksonville should be proud of, to bring it back to life. And you know, it's beyond the park, there's plan for housing around there, restaurants. It really could become a community area.
Yeah, let's hope for that. And I want to thank all four of you for joining us on this important day in the news. Nate Monroe, Shelton Hull, Mike Mendenhall, and Ann Schindler, four outstanding local reporters. And we so appreciate your regular participation on this program. So guys, thanks so much and have a great weekend.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, everyone. Well, up next, the show must go on is the saying in the theater world. One local theater is taking it to heart, even in this pandemic. We'll drop in on Phase 8 after this. It's the biggest stories affecting the Sunshine State. Hi, I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Join us Friday for the Florida Roundup.
Each week at noon, we interview newsmakers and people from across the state discussing the stories and issues that affect your life. What's driving the conversation in Florida?
Join the conversation on the Florida Roundup.
Every Friday at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Law Firm.
I'm Wayne Hogan. A mini stroke, or TIA, happens when blood is briefly blocked from the brain. It often warns of a looming stroke and requires immediate medical attention.
Learn more at waynehogan.law.
The Jacksonville Business Journal produces special events to recognize industry leaders and facilitate professional networking. Event listings and registration info at bizjournals.com/Jacksonville.
This week on Science Friday, as polar ice melts, new data showing a dramatic rise in sea levels over the next 30 years should be a boon to business.
They're telling you what's going to happen in 30 years. Now, if you can't make money out of this information, then you're not a very good businessman.
Plus, why do we itch? We scratch out the answer on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon at 3 here on WJCT News 89.9.
Is Trump's rhetoric on race, refusing to condemn white supremacy, praising discredited and racist race theories, aimed at dividing Americans pre-election?
It's no accident that all of these kind of flagrant comments, which feel really spontaneous, they all cohere around a narrative of elevating white Americans as the real Americans.
That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Starting at 4 on WJCT News 89.9.
It's time to listen to each other, to people you disagree with, to people you respect, to people you've never heard of, to people across America. It's time to listen to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, the Jacksonville Theater Company Phase 8 is debuting a new production this weekend. In fact, they're doing it all weekend. You can join the live stream of Chicago playwright Ike Holter's well-reviewed new show Exit Strategy all weekend long. How's this going to work? Well, here's Phase 8 Outreach Director Theo Canty. Hey, Theo. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
You know, we've all missed live performance in this pandemic, whether it's concerts or plays or whatever it may be. But at Phase 8 Theater Company, you are keeping on, as everyone is doing. And you've got a new production coming up. Is that right? What's happening?
Yeah, that's right. So we like everyone else, try to manage our way through this uncertain time and figure out how we can still offer art in a meaningful but safe way. So we are doing a virtual production of a play, Exit Strategy, and that's coming up in the next couple of days now. So that production will be going up on the 3rd of October, and that will be featured through On Broadway Demand, and it will run starting at 7, and it will go through to the next day at 7 p.m.
So wait a minute. You're going to launch a production Saturday, and it's going to go all through the day and night?
Yep. So it's almost like it is a stream. So if you feel like you want to go on at 4 o'clock in the morning, you are more than welcome to do that. And I just want to make sure that I also point out that play, Exit Strategy, was written by Ike Holter.
Okay, so tell me about the show and what people will get to watch and how it works so that it just keeps streaming.
Yeah, so the show is about a school closing in Chicago back in 2013, and the actors all recorded virtually from their own home. So we did a lot of rehearsing and figuring out how do you produce theater using the Zoom platform, so they were able to conquer that with their awesome director, Sam Corbett, and that will stream, that recording will stream on Broadway On Demand, and you can access that through our phase8.org website, and it'll give you all the instructions of how you link to that.
Okay, and so what are the biggest challenges of doing something like this? You know, putting on a production that's entertaining with all of the technical challenges of doing something virtually?
Yeah, I think the biggest challenge really was you have to be able to suspend your disbelief and pretend that someone else is there, right? I know when we act on stage, there's always someone to have action with. But in this instance, it's almost as if you were performing a one-man show in your apartment or your home to yourself, but still interacting with the other people around you. I was able to watch some of the rehearsals, and boy, I tell you, they are an amazing cast. Logistical things, getting props to different cast members. Two of our cast members live out of the city. So one's in Miami, and there's another one in Atlanta, Georgia. So we definitely came through some challenges, but I will say it's been awesome to be able to have such a reach in this platform. Without this, we would have never had actors from across the country be able to work with us. So that's been exciting.
That is exciting. And you're also conducting some classes and remote monologue projects at Phase 8 Theater Company. Tell us about that.
Yes. So earlier in the pandemic, we did a project that was called the Kitchen Monologues, and we reached out to a lot of old Phase 8 participants who had been in the theater with us before, and we just asked them to record different monologues in their kitchens and try to make space for those monologues in those kitchens. That was a really fun project, and we got a lot done out of it. We're still accepting some submissions, so if you have one, please submit it to our website, and we'll be happy to post those. We've also done some virtual learning. Jamario Steels, our founder, did the summer over some theater acting classes. And then Kelby Siddons, our artistic director, she did some theater or writing classes, playwright classes, which I was fortunate enough to attend. And both are just excellent teachers.
So lots happening, and Phase 8 is one of the most dynamic local theater companies in the area. And this is really cool that you will be able to watch their streaming premiere, the Florida premiere of Exit Strategy, this weekend. All through the weekend, as you pointed out, Theo, people need to check it out at phase8.org. That's phaseeight.org, or look on Facebook for their website there. Theo Canty with Phase 8 Theater Company. Have a great production this weekend. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Melissa. Thanks, everyone.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is show director. Our news director here at WJCT is Jessica Palumbo, and Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. Make sure to join us right back here again at noon for the Florida Roundup, where we discuss all the biggest stories making headlines around the state and take your calls statewide. That's the Florida Roundup today at noon. Meanwhile, this show will be up on our podcast link later today, wherever you listen to your favorite podcast shows, and it will rebroadcast tonight at 8 p.m. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks so much for being with us. Have a great weekend, everyone, and stay safe out there.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.